the government has a policy of zero net migration. As many people go into the country as out. And we do export a lot of people. We just export fairly useless elderly people who go and retire in Malta and France. And we bring in young, fit people. But we currently bring in a few more young, fit people than the elderly, useless people that we export. If the UK government got its way, and this is from its own Office of Budget Responsibility, and we had zero net migration, our debt would double. And it's already unsustainable. If we manage to persuade people to come to a country that we're trying very hard to not persuade them to come, they come and they share our debt. Immigration to a country like England is all about coming to somewhere that's in debt. And you come and share in, and you take a share of that debt, and you're productive, and you help reduce it. Now, this is hardly ever presented like this, apart from economists who show these kind of graphs. But if Europe reinforces the size of the wall around it, you'll probably have slightly higher fertility in North Africa and so on than would happen if Europe allows people to come in so that somebody can change my nappy in 30 years' time. Because if I'm lucky, I'll have a nappy rather than be dead. But that's simple demography. Okay. Other rapid changes in the world. These are the changes in the proportion of people worldwide with no qualifications. That's the women coming down every 5 years, the men coming down, and this is the increase in the numbers going to university. These are incredibly fast changes that are occurring. It's still the case, I think, that the majority of the world's adults are functionally illiterate, the majority of the world's children are literate, the majority of their children will have access to the web and Wikipedia. We've never had a change as fast as that. The invention of typing wasn't as fast as that. Here's the proportion of people in India and China who are expected to have no education, primary education, secondary education, and university education by 2050. This all matters because the best contraceptive in the world is going to university. By far the most effective way of deterring women from having children is going to university. Or putting off having children until they're in their 30s or late 30s or even early 40s. The only reason that the graphs for China don't carry on rising is because the population of China is going to fall. And we don't factor that in at all. A one-child policy for this amount of time means a falling population for China. It means all kinds of problems for China. Because it's going to rely on a very small number of young people, unless it would take some young people from India. You know, it's as much a problem for China as it is for other places. But the UN doesn't take this into account. The UN models don't take into account that there is a huge increase in the extent to which people are being given knowledge worldwide. Getting towards the end now, just another 5 minutes. Here's the basic graph for the world. This is the population estimates of 2100, at least until they went and upped them by another billion. Okay. This is the change that's happened. This is the percentage change in people per year that has led to this particular curve. And that's the projection forward. So the key points are that this really began around about 1850. Until 1850, we were fairly stable. Slightly higher for the 500 years before 1850, but not much. This explosion began around about then. And it's interesting to think about why it began then. I think it's got a lot to do with people from my particular country going out into the rest of the world and disrupting people's social systems that have managed to keep things fairly stable for generations. Within a country like Britain, fertility began to increase earlier, in France even earlier, when we enclosed the fields and threw people off the land. The one thing that's secondly most effective in terms of contraception to going to university is growing up in a village. Because you grow up in a village, you have to behave. You have to wait until you're allowed to marry and so on. So villages are very stable social systems. But we began to destroy village systems around about 1850. I could go on and on, but I won't. There were only four key events that affected this general rise. up to a rate of 2% growth per year. They were the economic crash and the Long Depression. In the 1930s in the United Kingdom, projections were made that the country would run out of people by the year 2000 because so few babies were being born in the Depression. The first one was the First World War and the pandemic, okay, which you'll know all about. Second was the crash. The third was the Second World War. And then exactly 9 months after the troops returned home, we began a baby boom. And the fourth is the Great Chinese Famine. Right? So you can see them there. And then, around about 1971, it stopped. Growth stopped. That growth of 2% a year was completely unsustainable. You've only got to take 2%, 2%, 2%, and you end up with us seething mass of bodies on the globe. Nobody is quite sure why it abruptly stopped then, but it did stop then. I think it is likely to be the success of feminism, and because feminists are still so angry about how much still has to be achieved, you don't get a group of feminists saying, look what actually happened, look what we achieved. This was just after the book The Population Bomb was written. This little spike here is the Ethiopian famine, and this is the situation that we know about, and this is the projection forward. And it could be quite different. So I'm going to end by showing you a couple of slides of that. Again, if you've got Excel, you can do this yourself. All you do is you take the global population that the United Nations says has existed every year, and you take 1 year away from the other to get the increase, or decrease, but it's always an increase. If you then take away one increase away from the other, you get the second derivative, you get the rate of acceleration of change. And what you see is that we had peak acceleration in the 1960s. There's our 1971 position. Again, we had acceleration in the 1980s. Then it slowed down. This is a little acceleration now. That is all it takes to go from 9 to 10 to 11 billion people. And then these are the official projections. And this is what I mean about being amateur. I noticed something about this, right? And I thought I was very clever, but it really isn't, right? This isn't gerbils or hamsters or elephants. These are human beings. And the interesting thing is that the gap between here and here is 22 years. The gap between here and here is 18 years. And those are the average differences between generations worldwide. So what you're looking at are baby booms. We have worldwide baby booms. The reason we don't know we have worldwide baby booms is that we haven't been counting babies very well until the 1950s. So we know we got baby booms in Europe, and we know we got them in America. But we also don't know that we had baby booms in China after the revolution, that we had a baby boom in India to do with independence, and the baby booms coincide. So if you just take these booms and just do something as simple as this, you get something very, very different to what the UN are producing. Let's see if I do it, and I go back. I've got the figure. And what you end up with by 2100 is a population of 7 billion rather than 9 or 10 or 11. And we're going to know very soon whether this is correct or whether it looks more like this. Unless Bill Gates' money paying every nurse who can find a live baby in Nigeria to register that live baby. The reason I go on about it is that in 1 year we had a doubling of the rate of babies in Lagos. 1 year. And it coincides with the year in which the money was being paid for the vaccination programs. But it will all become evident very soon. Money does work. Just two slides to conclude on, and then please do think of some questions for me. People are always talking about apocalypse. You know, things going terribly wrong, the way that societies crash, they can't deal with their environment and so on. We're heading for an ecological disaster, we're going to burn the planet up and so on. And I mean, I find all the stuff about burning the planet up fairly convincing, or very convincing. But we have this obsession with looking at what goes worse in the world. And the island which is always looked at is Easter Island. And there's been lots of work on Easter Island in the last 15 years, suggesting that when was it Captain Cook who turned up at Easter Island? Well, when people turned up on Easter Island for the first time and found that all the trees had gone and so on, it wasn't that the people were particularly stupid on Easter Island. It was partly because slavers had arrived shortly before from Peru and taken people to be slaves. So Easter Island had begun to interact with the rest of the world economy. Human beings are not necessarily doomed to manage their resources very badly. The opposite island is Tikopia, which is this tiny island in the Pacific, which as far as we can tell has managed to maintain a population of just 1,200 people for 3,000 millennium. The ways it maintained that population were not necessarily nice. It practiced infanticide to keep the population steady. And when the population became particularly high, there was a tradition that the young men should get in canoes and head out to find another island. And there weren't any other islands. Tikopia now has contraception, so it doesn't need infanticide. But it has stayed steady at a population density equal to central London for three millennia. The sad thing about Tikopia is that sea level rise has already occurred. So this brackish lake here, the salt water is beginning to come in. So again, after 3,000 years, interaction with the outside world, albeit for the fact we've actually heated up the planet enough to raise the sea level just enough to tip over, might be dooming that place. So thank you very much for your patience. Please do ask me questions about it. And please do think about having a go yourself, because you could do better than a geographer at this kind of thing. Thank you.
So let me ask you a question. When you present this to the UN, you're not a particularly close friend of the UN, but you may be visiting occasionally and presenting some of these data. What do they say? I mean, when you go back to that graph where you did your projection, how reasonable it is that something that did this all of a sudden would do this? Yeah. So what's their response?
Their response, which I think is entirely reasonable, is that they say it's quite amazing they're allowed to do these projections at all. And they have to do them in a way that gets agreement of enough countries. So they're not allowed to suddenly change their methods that much. And also that their central projection and the one that's lower is helping to dampen fears about population growth, which are rabid worldwide. So they see themselves as people who are already saying, when they talk about 9 or 10 or 11 billion, they're saying, don't worry. We could easily, we could live on a planet with 9 or 10 or 11 billion people. Partly because rich people can't eat 10 times the food of poor people. If they could, we would have problems, but human beings would only eat a certain amount of food. But the UN say that they're doing a reasonable job of helping calm things down, and if they were to head towards looking at this kind of thing, the amount of criticism they get could result in the population unit being stopped or shut down, or having somebody else put in charge of it, which would be an American rather than a very nice woman with dyed hair who currently runs it. That's the real politics of the UN. It feels itself as kind of a beacon of light struggling against forces which want to say the planet is heading for ruin, we need to put the walls up now, we need to have no immigration to rich countries because that will just result in more pollution, and we need to put sterilisation in the water in poor countries to force people to become sterilised, and more brutal things than that which are suggested.
So if you believe it's 7 billion here, why is your book called 10 billion?
Because that relies on no disasters. To get to 7 billion relies on no war, no famine, no great economic disaster, continued female emancipation. It's a utopia. It's entirely possible, but in Europe it's been a long time since the Second World War. I mean, if you just take the last 60 years and sort of say if this was to continue, it could all be fine. I have enough of a pessimist in me to think that something bad could go wrong worldwide of numerous kinds. In the book, I listed 42 possible things that could go bad. And by the time I got to the proofs, the website that these was on had added another 3. So I think 10 billion, 9 or 10 is what's likely if there are various disasters. A flu pandemic would be one. But that's the kind of thing which upsets.
So why would the disaster create more people?
People tend to have babies in the aftermath of disasters. So they tend to have babies shortly after war. The highest number of babies the UK ever had was in 1919. We had 1 million. They tend to have babies in refugee camps. They tend to have babies when they become poorer. So it's going to be interesting to see whether this occurs across Europe. And there's been some nice work which suggests that if you are a poor young woman, it makes more sense to become a teenage mother than to take a really dirt poor job. And if we create more poor young women, which we could easily do by increasing inequality in Europe, that make more sense. And the reason we say more sense is that people have followed up pairs of daughters, one of whom had a baby at, say, 18 or 19, the other who didn't. And often the mother does better than the one who didn't have the child. And we are currently heading to a greater and greater inequality. You know, wealth inequality is arising.
Nicola?
Hi, Danny. That's brilliant. Thank you. Just following on from that and your thing about the world wars and the Great Depression, we don't have those kind of wars anymore. I mean, you can say that the number of wars, the low intensity civil wars, the kind of conflicts, you know, Syria, Somalia, Sudan, Central African Republic, these are going on, and they sort of amount to what was going on in a world war, but they're all happening in isolated places. Now, wouldn't you expect those to have that same impact that you could see in very sharp, sudden changes?
I've got a graphic called, what's the most, probably a graphic which never produced, called Wars, Atrocities and Genocides of the 21st Century, where we put every single one on. You know, so the Holocaust is just one tiny part of it. And what that showed was that the deaths from all these little civil wars were actually equal until the year 2000. And that the amazing things happened in the last 10 years of the number of deaths worldwide from war has plummeted, according to people in Sweden who add it all up. So it's not just that those kind of wars were a different kind of war, although they may have generated many babies in the countries with the civil wars. The last 10 years have been the most peaceful 10 years for the last 120 years. And nobody knows why. And at the same time, the violence rates of males have plummeted. Pinker did the book, Better Angels of Our Natures. And again, we're not sure why the violence rates of men in general have plummeted, apart from a few men. And it only takes a few men and a few mass murders for the murder statistics to carry on going up. But on general, the average person is becoming less violent. It's always men anyway who are more violent. So the reason I'm trying to say, something quite incredible is happening with war in general. But it's only 10 years. And at the same time, we still have as many nuclear weapons as we always had pointed at each other.
Don't you see in the last 5 years, I mean, if you think about the current ongoing conflicts and their spread and the number of countries, I mean, are we just forgetting how many conflicts there were previously? But if you could reel off easily 15, 20 countries that have these sorts of, conflicts, some amassing to genocides that are ongoing at the moment.
They're ongoing, but they are not as bad as they were 10, 15 years ago. So we haven't done enough in Iraq. We could have done, but we haven't. The number of deaths in Syria is much lower. But we're not sure. We have very little idea about the system we've created and what we live in. But there are incredible changes going on at the moment. So it is possible that we could be looking at a very good 50 or 60 years ahead of us. The reason for worrying about it is I did a paper about the number of murders in the United Kingdom over the last 40 years. The number of murders had doubled. And by the year 2000, the murders were highest in poor areas, and poor men attacking other poor men. The murder rate in the last 10 years in Britain has halved, just in 10 years. The poor men have stopped killing other poor men. And in those last 10 years, about half of our murders have been the 7/7 terrorist attacks, Harold Shipman, one middle-class doctor who killed over 100 people, 50 Chinese migrants dying in the back of a lorry, some other migrants dying in the most bizarre sets of individual cases. And suddenly the epidemiology of murder, which I thought I might manage to create as a sub-discipline, has gone out of the window. There's no population patterns anymore. And if it's a macabre thing to be interested, but if you're interested in it worldwide, you're seeing more attacks like the one in Norway of a single man with a gun, or the one in Santa Barbara 2 days ago. Those kinds are becoming more frequent. The everyday getting drunk and beating up your mate and killing him is becoming less frequent, and that's reducing it. But my worry is the increase of this kind of really angry, mad kind of murder of people you don't know makes me worried about the future. Because until the last 10 years, the vast majority of everyday murders is somebody who loved you. That's the most likely person to kill you. And now it's becoming a stranger.
Finally, stranger danger is real.
but nothing compared to crossing the road. Yeah. That's what people have to remember. Of course, and that's the stranger driving the car.
Okay, any further questions to Danny? Yes, Olivia.
I was wondering in the UN model, so is it just only the past number of babies going to this? I can't believe it. Or what else can we do with this model?
Sorry.
Are you working on another model now?
She's a mathematical
mathematician. No, there are two things that go into the UN model. I mean, the lovely thing about the UN model is you don't have to model migration because nobody leaves the planet, which makes it much, much easier.
Just
yeah, for any country, your biggest problem is migration. Right, for the UN, it's less. The biggest thing by far, I should have said this in the UN model, is ageing. So the majority of the reason why we're going to get to 9, 10 or 11 billion is because many of us, not us, but actually our children, if you've got a daughter under the age of 12, she's probably going to be around. Son's slightly less likely. The majority of the reason for getting to that is we're going to be living longer. So it's more of us will be around at any one time. And if life expectancy increases, then the population of the planet increases at any one time. So that's in there, but that's much more stable. The babies are really matter because they have a kind of inflation component. One extra baby now, and you have to include the babies that they will have and the babies that they will have. But the bulk of the reason we're going up to 9, 10 or 11 is the good news that we're living longer. A small amount of it, yeah, give or take 2 billion either way, is the fertility. But those really are, it's as simple as that, that they look at, and they don't try to include long-term secular changes of when people become more educated. They behave differently. The other thing I tried to do in the book, which I completely failed to do here, is that it's all still done by women, as far as the UN are concerned. And in the book, I tried and managed, just by using search and replace, to talk about couples, and to include the fact that men are involved in this as well. And this is how simple it is. Because there are issues about dual careers. It takes two to have babies in general. If two young people want to have a child now, even if they're middle class and professional, the chances of both of them getting into a situation where they feel their careers are doing okay are very low. and this is pushing reducing fertility. It's also changing the demography of countries. So in the United Kingdom, we're getting this flocking in to people in London from the rest of the United Kingdom, not just from outside. Because in London, two of you can have a career. And nowhere else in the United Kingdom can two of you easily sustain two careers, which might involve losing a job every 5 or 6 years because precariousness is increasing. None of that kind of subtlety is included in the UN models at all.
Olivia, satisfied? You wanted a list of variables, didn't you?
I was wondering what you were working on another one.
I'm working on a book on political demography, where we may do another model, because the person I'm working with does lots of work on Asia, on low fertility. And so we could have a go producing something. But it's as soon as you make it at all complicated, you lose most people from the mechanics of it. The one thing I think is interesting for rich countries, the US and Europe and Japan, is the question about wealth and inheritance. Currently in Britain, you can't easily sustain a job in London unless you have rich parents who would help you buy a flat. It's not possible. In the 60s or 70s, you could do well based on your own merit. If you worked hard, you could get a good job and it paid enough and you could live. Inheritance is mattering more and more. So has the Piketty book been Thomas Piketty? It's been released here, okay. Inheritance is mattering more and more. I have 3 children. I have just managed to buy a house in Oxford, only just. They cannot live in Oxford in the future because there are 3 of them. If I'd only had 1 child, I could have passed all my wealth to that 1 child and they'd be okay. Now, what may begin to matter, what may begin to enter people's thinking in rich countries that are very unequal, is they may think I would have 1 child rather than 2, or 2 rather than 3, because I've got to pay for the university fees, I've got to help them get a flat, I've got to give them money for a deposit on the house, and so on. And if that begins to occur, we could see faster falling fertility in rich countries. It happened in the past in England, but it happened amongst working class people who had a single child, because it was the fastest way of getting your child from working class to middle class, putting all your eggs in one basket. And we may need to begin to model these things. I'm reluctant to do it because I don't want there to be a world in which people are thinking about whether they have children on the basis of money. But when you begin to model all these things, and relationships, and who people mixes with, which is most fascinating, you know, which boyfriends and girlfriends do you have, you suddenly find that money is incredibly important as a predictor of who you might stay with for more than one night. As societies become more unequal, when we were most equal in the 60s and 70s, there was much more spreading and people would meet and marry people of much more different backgrounds themselves. This is narrowing again and it might matter. And it would be lovely to begin to model these things to look at the predictability of what's occurring.
Okay, I think on that note, we will end this seminar and thank Danny. Yeah. The reason Danny came here is that he is one of the advisors, I think, of Claudia Berlin, who's a PhD student here. She's also a geographer. And she will be presenting in about how many minutes should we make?
Actually, right now.
A quarter to two. She will present her second year exam presentation, and you are all cordially invited to attend. Claudia, do you want to say 2-3 words on what you're going to talk about?
It will be fantastic, of course. It's going to be about determinants of cardiovascular healthcare in Switzerland and about the difficulties you might step into, but also the great data you have you can work with.
Okay, great data we have in 15 minutes. So thanks very much. Thanks again.
Thank you.